All right, this is concept 39. We're going to march forward, guys, until we get to concept 60. And you are the cutting edge, Marilla, that's going to get us there. So y'all stay with me. One thing I forgot to mention a minute ago, we're going to break next Sunday. We're not going to meet next Sunday night. It's Martin Luther King weekend. Let's take a break. People may be traveling. And then we'll resume 2 weeks from tonight, and we'll plow a straight furrow after that. So I'm busy with some things in January, and I need that week next week to get some things done, and then we'll resume. But tonight we're on concept 39, and let me catch you up because we've had a holiday break. And let me show you where we are in our study of fixing our eyes upon Jesus. Now, tonight we're going to be looking at this question, which is the identity of Jesus. Often in our culture, we're sort of spending time thinking about our identity in Jesus, but we're going to start tonight by talking about the identity of Jesus and how our identity in Him flows out of that. So we're going to spend a week or two on that. And this segment that we've been looking at, segment 4, is entitled The Author and Perfecter of Our Faith. And we started with concept 33, fixing our eyes upon Jesus. What it means to keep your eyes upon the Lord, concept 34. And then we looked at the gravity of Jesus, part 1, 2, 3, and 4. And now tonight we're going to take up this topic, the identity of Jesus. Now, brethren, let me say, if I must, that this is a fascinating study. And it's one that I've spent weeks working on because we had that long Christmas break. And I trust that you'll enjoy this. And it will be one that will help you understand some of the deeper themes of the Bible and how God chooses to reveal Himself to us, which is all completely fascinating to me. The passage we're looking at is Hebrews 12, 1 and 2, which says that we should run the race with endurance, fixing our eyes upon Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. And we've talked for the last several weeks about this idea, and that is this. If there's one thing you could do that would dramatically elevate your Christian experience, if there's one practical insight, the one I would recommend you think about is the insight of learning to keep your eyes upon Jesus at all times. If you can do that, He is the author and perfecter of our faith, which means He can strengthen our faith just by keeping our eyes upon Him. And remember that when our eyes are upon Jesus, our eyes are not on things that distract us from Him or tempt us away from Him. So keeping your eyes upon Jesus at all times has a way of sort of serving as the North Star on our spiritual compass. And when we do that, we constantly move forward in our journey. So last few weeks when we looked at the gravity of Jesus or the substance of Jesus, we consider these as things about His personhood. His preexistence, His prefiguration, His incarnation, His virgin birth, His crucifixion, resurrection, His ascension, and His second coming. Now, what we're going to do is talk about the identity of God and how God chooses to identify Himself. And there's a little exercise that I want you to go through. Dr. Youssef has kind of been talking about this on Sunday morning. So here's what I want you to do. In your notes, you see those little I am statements? What I want you to do is give me some self-descriptive statements that tell me who you are. I am, fill in the blank. Now just play with that for a minute and disclose yourself or reveal yourself through these statements. Keying off the verb form, I am, and tell me about yourself. So what is it? If I'm going to understand who you are, what are those things I need to know about you? Tell me about yourself. I am, fill in the blank. Play again. So how does God choose to identify Himself using language like this, or does He even use language like this in the Bible? And the answer to the question is that He does use this language. And when He uses it, He's got a clear intent in mind. He has a goal in mind that He's trying to identify. things about himself to those of us who were followers and even to the world. Now, self-identification has been something that philosophers down through the years has wrestled with. How do we accurately define ourselves, and how do we first identify ourselves? How do we then define ourselves? And then how do we reveal and communicate ourselves? Now, there was a famous statement that emerged from a philosopher who lived, I believe, in the 1600s. Yes, 1600s, who made this statement: I doubt, therefore I think, therefore I am. And the last part of the statement, I think, therefore I am, is this Latin phrase which says, cogito ergo sum. Because I think, that means I exist. And if you look at the statement in its fullness, he started with doubting, which meant that he was able to think, and because he can think, he derives a conclusion that he exists. Now, on the surface, that seems like a pretty self-obvious or a pretty obvious deduction, but notice that this is the product of deep philosophical thought. I know you're impressed. Don't all start throwing your pens at me, okay? But being fair, it is a profound observation that we can doubt, we can think, therefore we exist. Now, where did this statement come from? Descartes, who was a French philosopher, was looking for a philosophical proof of existence based upon the fact that someone capable of any form of thought necessarily exists. That was what he was trying to conclude. It was the end of Descartes' search conducted for a statement that couldn't be doubted. In other words, it couldn't be invalidated. Since he was the one doing the doubting, he found that he could not doubt that he himself existed. So this is it. This is an identifying statement here that he is one who thinks, has a capacity to doubt because he thinks, therefore he exists. So he uses the phrase, I think, therefore I am. And notice that that's language that I asked you to use a minute ago to identify yourself. I am from the millennial generation. I am a gardener. I am a lover of outdoors. I am a goal-oriented person, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, where do we find this language in the Bible? Is it even in the Bible? Oh, yes, it is. You'll find this fascinating. All right, self-identification. Now, this is sort of the joke for tonight. Now, in plain English, we don't think to ourselves, I doubt, I think, therefore I am. Rather, we think like this. For men, I eat, therefore I am. Right, Robin? For women, I shop, therefore I am. Hey, come on now. That's fair. That's funny. High school, junior in high school, I can drive, therefore I am. College freshman, I tweet, therefore I am. Businessman, I get a paycheck, therefore I am. Now, I think I added another one in here. I did. Senior citizen, I watch Wheel of Fortune, therefore I am. My 87-year-old mother-in-law loves Wheel of Fortune every night at 7 o'clock. Oh, my goodness. So, these are ways that we validate our existence. Now, we're not as deep as Descartes in the way we say it, but if we were to say, how is it that you validate your sense of self and that you're here? These are the ways that we do that in some of the core ways that are associated with our genders and our stages of life. And again, this is designed to be a little bit on the funny side. Now, man's concept of God. When we think about God, apart from God revealing Himself to us, how do we identify God? How do we conceptualize God? Well, some of the great thinkers of the past made these statements. Plato, the great philosopher, said that the Father and Maker of this universe is past finding out. In other words, God exists, but in an unknown, vague capacity. We can't know anything specific about Him. If he does exist, He's past finding out. His way of referring to God was that God was a geometrician. That means He was an expert in geometry or angles and how to put things together so that they fit and that they worked. That was his observation. Aristotle referred to God as the prime mover. We probably all used that language before. Hegel referred to God as the absolute. There's none above Him. What He says goes, and there's none beyond Him. Spencer referred to God as the unknowable, similar to Plato. And notice that these are all observations about the identity of God. And apart from God revealing himself to us, how can we conceptualize him without God's help? Freud referred to God as a magnified father. And he theorized that man... He theorized that man created God because we needed something to make us feel secure in a world of chaos. And the father figure in our lives is designed to make us feel protected and provided for. And so the concept of God was nothing more than a projection of a father figure, which was nothing more than a projection, and it didn't really exist. Helen Keller, listen to this story. I'll read it to you. Helen Keller, when she was 19 months old, she contracted an illness that left her blind and deaf for life. It was not until she was 10 years old that she began to have meaningful communication with those around her. It occurred when her gifted teacher, Ann Sullivan, taught her to say water as Ann spelled water on the palm of her hand. From that pivotal experience, Helen Keller entered the wonderful world of words and names, and it transformed her life. Once Helen was accustomed to this new system of communication with others, her parents arranged for her to receive religious instruction from an eminent Boston clergyman named Phillips Brooks. Listen to this. One day during her lesson, Helen said these remarkable words to Phillips Brooks. I knew about God before you told me. I just didn't know his name. I knew about God before you taught me about him, but I just didn't know his name. And see, without a name, you can't really identify someone. She knew vaguely that a person of God existed, but she couldn't identify him. And names is what we use to identify people. So as man, without help from God, tries to conceptualize God, this is some of what we come up with. Now, if we're going to have an accurate perception of God, then we must let God speak for himself. And God chooses, and we must look at God in terms of how he chooses to reveal himself. So with that in mind, let's go to this story. And let me read it to you. It's found in the book of Exodus. And this is an effort by God to define himself. Moses, in the Exodus chapter 3, Moses is up on Mount Horeb, and he sees this sight that catches his attention of a bush that was burning, but it wasn't consumed by fire. Something mystical about this. Yeah. So he approaches this bush, and God starts talking to him through the bush. And listen to what God says about himself. Verse 11. But Moses said to God, God has already told Moses that he wants Moses to go into Egypt and bring his people out. And this is Moses' response to this marvelous commission to go bring the Israelites out of Egypt. He says, but Moses said to God, who am I? There's that question, who am I? Underline that, Leah. Ooh. Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? Now notice that Moses is trying to figure out, where do I fit into this scheme of things that I should attempt something this amazing? And he said, God says to Moses, certainly I will be with you, and this shall be a sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. Then Moses said to God, well, behold, I'm going to the sons of Israel, and I'm going to say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. Now they may say to me, what is his name? Or what shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. Or translated another way, I am that I am. Remember Descartes said, I think, therefore I am? God uses that language here. He says, I am who I am. And he said, then you shall say to the sons of Israel, I am has sent me to you. And God furthermore said to Moses, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has sent me to you. This is God talking. Listen to what he says. This is my name forever, and this shall be my memorial name to all generations. Now, if this is how God names himself, by using the language I am, isn't that a strange way to identify yourself? He doesn't say I am and then put a name on the end. But his name rather is the verb, the phrase, I am. Now, that's pretty deep. And the implications of that are somewhat staggering. Let's talk about it. God's call upon Moses to lead the exodus of Israel out of Egypt threw Moses into an identity crisis. Who am I that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? Who am I that I should do this? Do you ever ask yourself that question? Who am I that I should be doing this? Am I the one who should be doing it? Is my makeup such that I can actually perform this task and do it well and do it right and do it the way it's supposed to be done? We find ourselves asking that question occasionally. Who am I that I should do that? God tries to assure him by pledging his powerful preference. Well, it's not going to be you. You're not the one that's going to be doing it, Moses. But I'm going to be with you, and we're going to accomplish this Herculean task. Moses questions whether they will know who this God is. What if they say, who is this, and what is his name? God says, I am who I am. You say to them, I am has sent you. The word I am is a verb from the Hebrew word hayah, which means to be or to exist. So God identifies himself using the verb form that we usually start with and turn into a sentence or a description to talk about who we are. But God rather just uses the verb himself and stops there. I am who I am. And that word means to be or to exist. So God's name reveals himself to be the self-existent, self-sustaining, eternal, and unchangeable God who transcends time. By identifying himself as the great I am, this is what we learn about God. He is the God who exists. He self-exists. He self-sustains his existence. Because he is the God who is, that means he continues in that form or in that nature, and that he is unchangeable by transcending time. So the way God chooses to identify himself is someone who marches forward through time unchanged, independent from all creation, and existent and eternal and self-existent. Now, let me ask you this question, or we'll get to that in just a second. The word Yahweh is derived from the word Hayah. When we talk about God as Yahweh, which is a word that's found throughout the Old Testament, Yahweh is a name we use for God. It's actually a derivative of the verb form Hayah. In fact, it formed the most sacred name of God to the Jews and is translated Lord. And what it expresses is the essential nature of God as same or unchangeable. Notice that the name of God, Yahweh, flows out of his identity, and his identity, I am who I am, flows out of his existence, I am. Therefore, God's name, identity, and existence are all tied together. That makes sense? At least this is how God chooses to communicate himself to us. Now, because of the Jews' reverence for God's name, Yahweh, they shied away from ever pronouncing it. And this is what they did. They took the vowel pointing. When Hebrew was written, it was just block letters. And if I can use a near reverent term, it looked like chicken scratch. I mean, that's what Hebrew looks like. And it didn't have vowel pointings. But to help people later learn how to read and pronounce Hebrew, they added vowel pointings, which are little points and expressions in it. So what the Jews did was they took the vowel pointing for Adonai, another name of God, and put it on Yahweh. And this led to the pronunciation Jehovah. So the name Jehovah really doesn't exist in the Bible. It's a combination of the vowel pointing of Adonai and the letters for Yahweh. And once you put that pronunciation on Yahweh, the vowel pointing for Adonai, you get the name Jehovah. But Jehovah is really not a name. It's a construction grammatically that they came up with because they didn't want to pronounce the name of God. And remember, the second commandment says, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. So to avoid disobeying that commandment, they just never used the name Yahweh. They just avoided it altogether. And then they took the name Adonai, the vowel pointing, they swapped it over to Yahweh and formed a new name called Jehovah, which is nothing more than fictitious, but that's how we refer to it. But really the root word to God's name is this word Yahweh. Does that make sense? Everybody tracking with me? All right, now, let me ask this question. Is the burning bush meant to symbolize the self-existence of God in some way? God is completely intentional. And when He appears in a burning bush, there's some symbolism behind that. What, in your opinion, was the symbolism of God being in that burning bush? Pardon? All right. Yep. Some like that theme. What else do you see in the burning bush? Pardon? Yeah. It's here's a natural bush that has an aversion to fire, but it's on fire and not consumed. What's that all about? All right, that's that self-sustaining idea. Okay. Yep. Why did God appear in the burning bush? Nobody's ever really figured this out. We just have theories. I'm sorry.
It could mean that it's going to last forever, the bush.
Okay. Does it have reference to the eternal nature of God? That the bush is on fire but never consumed? In the Bible, the nature of God is referred to as a consuming fire throughout in various places in the Bible. And here this consuming fire is occupying this bush, and the fire and the bush are perpetual in existence. Does that have some reference to God's statement, I am, which is perpetual in existence? He doesn't say, I was. He doesn't say, I'm going to be. He just says, I am, which transcends time and is perpetual in nature. And it exists in a verb form. I mean, it's such an intriguing way to identify yourself. And what we can learn from it is that it apparently refers to the characteristics that He has, that He is eternal, self-sustaining, and self-existent. So He uses that term that way. And I'm assuming there's some connection between the name of God, I am who I am, and that burning bush. Now, I don't have the discernment or smarts to figure out quite how it connects, but I know there's some connection there. Now, let's just keep thinking about that. Now, what I want to show you in the Old Testament is how God builds certain benefits to us, His people, around His name. In His name, God doesn't have a first, middle, and last name, but God has a core name with a variation of themes that talk about how God reveals Himself to us, His people. And the way God reveals Himself to us has something to do with our need for God. Notice how this plays. In Genesis 22:14, this is Abraham talking. He uses the term Jehovah Jireh right here, or Yahweh Jireh, which is translated, the Lord provides. Remember the context of that? They're on Mount Moriah. Abraham takes Isaac up on the mountain to sacrifice him. Right before he slits his throat, God stops him. And Abraham looks over in the bush, and there's an animal there that he pulls from the bush and offers on the altar in place of Isaac. And Abraham says, Jehovah Jireh, the Lord provides. And remember, Isaac had asked him on the way up to the mountain, we've got the wood, we've got the fire, we've got the sticks, where's the sacrifice? And Abraham says to his son, God's going to provide. Well, God provides, and it's not Isaac. God spares Isaac and provides in his place. And so Abraham took from that experience, God always provides when there's a need. So you've got Jehovah Jireh. Another word, Jehovah Rophe. This is the Lord heals. Exodus 15. God says to the Israelites coming out of Egypt, if you behave, keep my commandments and observe my statutes and ordinances, the diseases that are upon the Egyptians, I'll never place upon you. In other words, I'm going to spare you of those diseases. And here refers himself to the Lord who heals or keeps us healthy. And that is one of the names of God. Notice the core name Yahweh, and the word Rophe means healer. Here's another one, Yahweh Nisi. This is the Lord is our banner. A banner was something that troops carried with them into battle so that when there was conflict or when there was an enemy threatening them, the Lord served as their banner and defeated their enemies. And there's a story about that in Exodus 17. Another name, Jehovah Makedesh. This is taken from Leviticus, which talks about the people of God being holy as God is holy. And it says here that the Lord is the one who sanctifies us or purifies us. Another name of God is the word Yahweh Shalom. The Lord is our peace. So God Wherever God goes, His peaceful presence goes with Him. So when the Lord is in our hearts, God's presence means peace. Fifthly, Jehovah Rohi, the Lord is my shepherd, Psalm 23:1. Yahweh Sabaoth is the Lord of hosts or protector. And Yahweh Tzedekenu is the Lord is our righteousness from Jeremiah. And one more, Yahweh Shammai, which refers to the fact that the Lord is there or the Lord is present. Now, notice that all these names, Robin, flows off of one core name. And so God gives to us, flowing out of this core, all these appendages that refer to the way He ministers to us in our time of need. And these things form the nature of God in relationship to us so that as these needs present themselves, we have a God who's there to meet those needs. So the first part of the name, or the core part of the name, is God's basic self-existent eternal nature, but then He attaches a description to His name that describes how He loves, cares, and ministers to us. So God is revealing Himself to us as a God who loves and cares for us, and it kind of looks like this. Notice that Yahweh's the core, but God reveals Himself in so many different ways based upon our need of the moment. The eternal nature of God doesn't change. Our needs do change, and God ministers to our needs according to these various names. So the names of God in the Old Testament center around the name Yahweh. And the description that God adds to that core name is always in reference to the way He ministers to us in our time of need. In the New Testament, Paul uses the phrase, God will richly supply your needs in Christ Jesus. And so when we talk about how God reveals Himself or God's identity, He reveals Himself as the self-existent, self-contained, eternal, unchangeable God, but who adjusts Himself for what we need from Him. So therefore, He is the God who provides. He's the God who heals. He's the God who leads us into battle. He's the God who sanctifies us, the God who is our peace, our shepherd, our protector, our righteousness, and God who provides His presence when we're alone. Now, you see the pattern in the Old Testament of how God reveals Himself through these names. Now, watch this. Wendy, are you with me? Stay with me now. Now, one of the most amazing things that happens when Jesus comes is that Jesus identifies Himself with this Yahweh personality of the Old Testament, much to the dismay and scandal of the religious people of His day. Watch this. In John chapter 8, verses 54 through 59, Jesus is in a very tense conversation with the Pharisees and the Sadducees who don't know who He is. They can't figure out how He's able to do what He does, and they're still trying to peg this guy and identify who He is. And so Jesus responds to them with these words. He says, "If I glorify Myself, My glory is nothing." In other words, self-glorification is not what true glory is all about. "It is My Father who glorifies Me, of whom you say He is our God. But you have not come to know Him. You talk about this God being your God, but you really don't know this God. You just think you do. But I know Him." Jesus says, "But I know Him. And if I say that I do not know Him, then I'm going to be a liar just like you." Whoa. That's taking on the religious people of the day. That if I say I don't know this God, then that's going to make me a liar just like you, which is what you are. "But I do know Him and I keep His word. Your father Abraham rejoiced to see My day. He saw it and was glad. The Jews therefore said to Him, 'You're not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham?' And Jesus said to them, 'Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born, I am.'" Same language God used in Exodus hundreds of years prior to this. Notice the Jews' reaction to what Jesus is saying. "Therefore, they picked up stones to throw at Him, but Jesus hid Himself and went out of the temple." Now, why did they react the way they did to Him making the statement?
He was comparing Himself to God.
More than comparing.
Same.
He was identifying himself with God. With the great I Am of the Old Testament. Remember, they were afraid to pronounce the name Yahweh in the Old Testament. And here Jesus is saying, I'm of the one in the same essence with that great I Am. I mean, this was, folks, complete scandal. So the Jews reacted forcefully. In John chapter 10, verse 10, Jesus makes this statement. He says, I and the Father are one. The word oneness there refers to being one of the same essence. What did the Jews do when he said that, Donna?
They took up stones again.
All right, now where have we seen that before? Yeah, just a chapter before, in John chapter 8, last part of John chapter 8, Jesus said, I am, he identified himself as, even before Abraham was born, I am. The Jews picked up stones to stone him. Then he says in chapter 10, I am the Father of one. The Jews again pick up stones to stone him. Why did they do that? Jesus said, why are you going to throw stones at me? Because you, a man, are making yourself out to be God. I mean, what Jesus was doing here was unmistakably clear. So, yes. Yes. What does it say? Well, thank you, ma'am. We'll fix it. Hang on 1 second. Hold on, guys. Don't go away.
Can I make a comment while you're teaching?
Yes, you may.
I find it very interesting that they were so afraid of saying his name, of being irreverent. So they just, as the Pharisees did, they just make up a name for him. How much more irreverent is that? Like, you don't, you're, I don't, it's just, to me, ironic. I don't want to say your name because I might offend you, so I'll just make up a name.
The ultimate insult.
Yeah.
Not accepting your name. The way you're choosing to identify yourself, I'm not willing to let you do that.
So I don't even want to say Jehovah anymore.
That's how it worked. Okay, well, that's how it works.
Very interesting.
Yes. Now, notice how Jesus is identifying himself as the great I Am. That is the equivalent of saying that I am the Father of one. And the Jews knew exactly what he meant when they took up stones in both instances and were going to kill him. There is no way you can identify yourself with the great I Am. That is blasphemy. And so in their righteous indignation, they went after him. Now, Jesus' self-identity. Here's what he's doing. Jesus is using the hallowed name of God to refer to himself. By assuming the name of Yahweh, Jesus identified himself with the Father God, implying that he was one in essence with the Father. John 10:30. In the mind of the Jews, that was absolute blasphemy. Notice the similarity of their responses in John 8:59 and 10:31. They took up stones to stone him. His intent could not have been clearer to his listeners. They knew exactly what he meant. So Jesus, by identifying himself as I Am, whoops, was equating himself, with the self-existent, eternal, and unchangeable God. That the Jews completely understood his intent is evidenced by their indignant, hostile response of aggression toward him. He removed himself from the scene so that they couldn't destroy him and take his life. So in the Old Testament, Moses says, well, who am I going to say sending me to get you out? God says, you tell them I Am is sending you in. I am who I am. That's my memorial name to all generations. And then 1,500 years later, Jesus comes along and says, before Abraham was, I am. And the Jews knew exactly what that meant. Now, in the same way that in the Old Testament, God's name Yahweh was the core around which was wrapped several things about God in relationship to us. Look now at how Jesus identifies himself through these I Am statements. And you want to see the New Testament I Am statements through the lens of the Old Testament name of God, I Am. First of all, Jesus said, before Abraham was, I am. That means he's identifying himself as the eternal God. Abraham lived 100 years previously. But notice that he said, before Abraham even existed, I existed prior to Abraham's existence hundreds of years ago. Notice that Abraham does not say, before Abraham was, I was. He doesn't say that. He says, before Abraham was, I am. And there's that present tense verb that signifies his perpetual existence. He uses the word I, the personal pronoun, from the word ego, which is a first person personal pronoun. In the singular, that's translated I or me. And in the plural, it's translated we or us. So when he's identifying himself as the I here, he's using the first person personal pronoun. And then the word am, which is this basic verb, I, me, which means to be, exist, or isness, first person singular, in the same way that it goes. Now, in the Greek language, I want you to notice this. If you wanted to say I am, you could say that using just that verb form, I, me. But when you add the personal pronoun to it, you reinforce your own identity and existence even more. And so when Jesus said, not only I am using a verb, but using a noun and a verb, that combined form lends even greater force to who he is. And Jesus is identifying himself specifically as the I am that was equated with the Old Testament. And even before Abraham was, I am. Not before Abraham was, I was. Before Abraham was, I am. Now, notice these I am statements. This is absolutely fascinating. Look at this. Before Abraham was, I am. This is where Jesus identifies himself as the great I am. Now, Patricia, watch how Jesus takes this core name, I am, and develops outside of that several things about himself in relationship to us and our need for him. Here we go. Jesus said, I am the bread of life. John 6:35, verses 48 and 51. This was a statement he made right after he fed the 5,000. I'm the bread of life. There was manna that came down from heaven that fed you physically in the desert, in the Israelites, but I am the bread of life who feeds you spiritually. Number two, I am the light of the world. In John 8, Jesus heals a blind man, Donna. He gives a blind man sight, and then he says, I'm the light of the world. I've allowed this man the ability to see because I gave him light. And Jesus identifies himself as the light of the world in response to the darkness that a blind person would see physically. He says, I am the door, referring to Jesus being the entrance way into a relationship with God, which then gives us eternal life. Then he says, I am the good shepherd. In John 10, he talks about the hirelings that don't really care for the sheep. As soon as the wolf shows up to kill the sheep, the hireling flees. But the good shepherd gives his life for the sheep and lays down his life to protect the sheep. He says, I am the resurrection. This is right before he raises his close friend Lazarus from the dead. Lazarus had died, was in the grave about 4 days, fully embalmed. The stone was up against the mouth of the tomb. Jesus delays while he's a few days away, comes to the city of Bethany. All kinds of Jews from Jerusalem are in Bethany comforting Mary and Martha, Lazarus' sisters. And then Jesus shows up and says, okay, let's go to the tomb. And Martha says, no, we're not going to the tomb. He's already putrefying and there's going to be a stench. And Jesus says, just don't worry about it. Let's go to the tomb. They get to the tomb. Jesus says, roll the stone away. They do. And then Jesus prays and then calls out with this loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And those grave clothes pop right off and Jesus walks out of the grave. I've often wondered at the number of funerals I've been at, what would happen if the person in the casket suddenly sat up and walked down the center aisle? What would we do? How would we react to that? We'd all scatter, huh? All right, well, that's what Jesus said. That's what Lazarus did. And then Jesus turned and says, take the grave clothes off of him, unwrap him. And then he says, I'm the resurrection and the life. In other words, Jesus gives us power over death. I am the resurrection. Then he says, I am the way. Follow me. I'm the straight and narrow pathway, the way of truth. Then he says, I am the truth. And then he says, I'm the life. And all these three words, this cluster of words, are all found together in John chapter 14, verse 6, one single verse. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. Now, if you put all three of those together, here's what you get, John. I'm the true way to life. I'm the truth. I'm the true way to life. And Can you imagine somebody walking in this room and making a statement like that? I'm the truth. Hello? Anybody want to meet me? Here I am. Years ago, Robert Shuter tells the story of being in the middle of a church service and a guy walking down the center aisle proclaiming himself to be Jesus while the children's choir was singing up on the stage and they're on television. And so Shuler thought this was a really cool move. He looked down at the guy and says, "Show me the blood in your palms of your hands." I wouldn't have thought to say that. Oh my gosh. But anyway, they come get the guy and haul him out because he's an imposter. But when a guy walks down the center aisle and says, "I'm Jesus," I mean, it creates major shockwaves. It was an earthquake right in the middle of a church service. Now, when Jesus says, "I'm the way, the truth, and the life," it wasn't any less impactful. It was just as dramatic when he says that. And the Pharisees flip out. Then he goes on to say, "I'm the true vine. He who abides in me and I abide in him, he not only has life, but he bears fruit." And then Jesus says, "I am the Alpha and the Omega." Now notice that all of these I am statements are in the Gospel of John except the last one. That's found in the book of Revelation. Now, who wrote the book of John? Who wrote the book of Revelation? All right, same author, different books. But this is the one I am saying that's not found in the Gospel of John. But it's encompassing of all the other ones. He says, "I'm the Alpha and the Omega." Now, what does Alpha and Omega refer to? What? Alpha is the first letter in the Greek alphabet. Omega is the last. So from beginning to end, I am God. I cover the whole span of time. So here Jesus is making these amazing statements centering around the name I am, which was the verb form that God Almighty, El Shaddai, used to identify himself in the Old Testament. So we see Jesus following the pattern of God the Father in the Old Testament, but in the New Testament identifying himself as a God who loves you, cares for you, and is going to meet your need. All flowing out of the core name Yahweh or I Am, and then Jesus uses all these word pictures to define his relationship to us, people that are needy human beings. So, the identities of Jesus centering around I Am. Here's what you got. I'm the bread of life. I'm the light of the world. I'm the door. I'm the good shepherd. I'm the resurrection. I'm the true vine. I'm the way, the truth, the life. And I'm the Alpha and the Omega. And what you see happening here was the exact same way that God revealed himself in the Old Testament. There was a core name by which God identified himself, which was essentially a verb form, I am. And that referred to the unchangeable, self-contained, self-sustained, eternal nature of who God was. But then that core name took on different expressions in how God chose to relate himself to us as his people. I'm the bread of life. I'm the light of the world. Keeps us out of darkness. The bread of life nurtures us. So, the door opens for us. It allows us entrance into God's kingdom. So all these different ways are ways that Jesus identifies himself. And it is eerily similar to the way God revealed himself at multiple times and ways in the Old Testament. Everybody got this all written down? You got it? Okay. Now here is, in summary, concept 39. Jesus stunned the religious establishment of his day when he identified himself as being one with God, the great I Am of the Old Testament. So, to understand who we are in relationship to God, we got to understand who Jesus was and is. So our identity in Christ starts with the identity of Christ. And flowing out of Jesus' identity then shapes and forms our identity in Him. And this is what Michael's talking about on Sunday morning, so you see this theme running throughout the Bible. So what we're going to do next week is we're going to look at all of these I am sayings and elucidate these and expand these so that we have a full sense of who God is and who He reveals Himself to us, how He reveals Himself to us in relationship to us and our need. So we're going to look at all these I am statements. And then once we've established that, then we look at this question. What is, after we've clearly identified who Jesus is, then from there we identify our identity in Him. Identify Him first. Then we can define the relationship of our identity to Him. Now, I did say we're going to do this next week, but we're going to skip next week, right? MLK weekend, we're going to take a break. We won't meet next Sunday night. Let's skip that week. I'll see you in 2 weeks, and we're going to take this up in concept 40. Is going to be this, the identity of Jesus part 2. We'll look at the I am sayings of Jesus.